everybody. My name's Ed. I'm with Ready Northwest Emergency Management, and we are creating state. It is a place where we can get together and learn the lessons that were learned the hard way when it comes to disaster response and emergency management, so that we can help others not repeat those same mistakes and provide the tools, resources, and education needed. We also want to infuse perspectives from everyone by bringing on guests who can give their point of view, maybe experienced disasters or thought leaders within the emergency management industry.
This is Bill Fogarty. I am a former Office of Emergency Services Director and a current lieutenant with the San Mateo County Sheriff's Office. And my background really is thinking about who this podcast could be for. We're looking for emergency managers, young and old, people who are really willing to look beyond the classroom and use real life experiences to help them prepare for whatever it is that may be coming their way for critical events, major events, or disasters. We also are striving to bring tech to look at these problems and achieve solutions to really anything that we could potentially deal with or address or look beyond what's been taught in an academic field. As we know, as we progress in time, technology sometimes and often helps us better the situations that we're in.
You can find the schedule of topics for State of Ready on stateofready.com's website or Bill's website, 21kletz, CLETS.com. We aim to post on Wednesdays, and you can find our podcast series on the Anchor app, Apple iTunes, Overcast, Pocket Cast, and Radio Public.
Our scheduled events upcoming will include this week's presentation on exercises,
We'll also talk about stakeholder meetings,
volunteer groups and VOADs,
liaisons,
websites and social media,
running evacuation drills,
go bags in case of disaster,
emergency management planning for communities and organizations,
hazard mitigation,
supply chain management,
risk gap analysis,
emergency alert and notifications.
if you need to reach us, you can reach us on Twitter at State of Ready or at 21 Klutz. Thank you for joining us. We look forward to hearing you listen to our podcast.
Of Ready. My name is Ed. I'm the owner of Ready Northwest Emergency Management, an emergency management consulting firm that helps small and medium-sized businesses be prepared for, respond to, and recover from disasters. And Bill?
Bill Fogarty from the San Mateo County. I am currently a lieutenant with the office. I am a former Office of Emergency Services Director. My experience revolves around going to scenes of disasters, whether that's a San Bruno gas pipeline gas line explosion, or it's airplane crashes, or earthquakes, or flooding that has ended up taking place. The reason for this interview series is really to help emergency managers, both young and old, first responders, press information officers, and social media people to go ahead and have a better understanding of what we're looking for during a critical event and how to go ahead and safely recover from the event using planning, technology, and great experience.
Absolutely. And if you followed in from our last podcast that we had last week, we talked about large events and the incident management and the planning that goes into making sure that everybody who attends those events is safe and secure. But then what if something bad happens? What kind of incident management has to go into that? Because there is a lot that's going to happen once an incident or a disaster occurs at your large event, whether it's a conference, a concert, a festival, a parade. There's a lot of people in an enclosed space, and if something happens, there's going to be a lot of people that are going to start to come. So who are those responding agencies? Well, they could be anybody. They could be mostly law enforcement, fire department, EMS, who are usually the first on scene. But then you may be having to deal with public works and then the private sector. If it's on somebody's property or if it is at a facility, you're going to have the private sector of people who are in charge of that facility be there. So those are a couple of things you have to reach out for and understand who's going to be participating.
And one of the major things that we really need to think about is whether or not those responding agencies want to train with you. In some agencies from different disciplines maybe don't get along with each other and don't really want to be training side by side. While this is a difficulty, it could be overcome, but we also need to think about, do they want to train with the other people? And if they don't want to train with them, the exercise is probably not going to be very successful. The other thing you need to think about is what's the cost for the training? And by cost, we need to think about as many things as we can. The cost for the venue, the insurance for the exercise itself, the equipment you will be using, radios, simulation. In addition to that, the overtime and the time of the people who are volunteering to be there. Because a lot of times you can have volunteers who will be there for free, but a lot of times you'll end up with people who are working in public safety who there's an additional task or assignment that's assigned to them to go ahead and be better prepared for a critical event.
Yeah, absolutely. And budgets are tight. If any of you out there listening, I know Bill, you're in the public sector. You understand public or budgets are really tight when it comes to training dollars. There's not a lot to go around, and there are a lot of priorities that a small pot of resources and funding have to be dedicated to. So if you are going to be participating in these exercises there, you have to realize what the cost is and maybe see if that could be offset by either the facility or the event managers who are putting it on. When you consider, go ahead.
And a lot has to do with exercise duration and how long you're planning to do the training for. Oftentimes, what I've tried to do is have the training occur while people are on duty, trying to minimize the actual cost for the first responders who are going to be going to the event and really trying to make it more conducive to them. But one of the things you have to think about for that is offering in different dates and different times. A fire schedule often has 3 or 4 days in a row, whereas a law enforcement schedule often has 8 to 10 or 12 hours in a row with rotating days off. And so as a result of that, you really need to be conscientious of the dates and times that you schedule these exercises.
And then in addition to that, duties and resources change based upon shifts. So if you're trying to get everybody, you may have an event that overlaps between a day shift, a grave, and may go into a little bit part of, or mostly in the swing shift. Each one of those assignments, those people who are working at that particular time may not be familiar with daytime operations versus nighttime operations, or may have additional duties. So if you're going to be training on multiple days and times, you have to consider the resources. There's not a lot of people who may be available for a graveyard shift for training and still be available for calls within the community. And so you need to consider when you're going to be offering these days and times for individuals to come in and train to make sure that it is enough that everybody across the board gets the resources to be able to train with them. Because depending on how long your event is, if you have a singular event with 20,000 people coming to a concert that's going to last for 6 hours, is going to be completely different than having 20 or 30 or 40,000 people coming for a conference or a Super Bowl like event that lasts for a week. So as you can see, depending what type of event you have, Bill, go for it.
And that also involves the weather conditions of the people who are actually there participating in the exercise. Oftentimes, you need to think about if it's too hot, what kind of additional supplies you need to have on hand, like water or ice or something to cool fans, cool people down. If it's cold, you can think about heaters and where you can safely locate those or maybe indoor shelters. If it's raining outside, whether or not that's the best time to do exercises, I personally don't think that people melt in the rain. I think it's a good opportunity for people to try that. But also, I think you need to think about whether or not you have to deal with snow and what that looks like and whether or not that provides a realistic training environment or whether or not it's just going to end up leading to more injuries than really the exercise is worth.
Exactly. Because when you consider that, if this is a voluntary exercise that people can volunteer to come to, weather is a big motivating factor for a lot of people. If it's just miserable outside, if it's too hot, or if it's snowy and cold, if it's a voluntary exercise, you may not get as much turnout as if it was a really pleasant and nice day. And so you have to consider the type of season and the weather conditions when you're going to invoke these training exercises, because these may matter to some people. And if it's a snow day, you know, if they have family or childcare and it's called as a snow day for children at school, they may not be able to get childcare and go. So you may lose a majority of your resource staff to come and participate during this exercise. So many different variables and conditions you have to consider when dealing with weather and having to plan that out when you have that exercise going.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think the next thing really to think about is the public versus private areas and who's really in charge of that area and what they want to be seen or not seen. A lot of times when we try to do exercises, we try to do them outside the public eyes. But there are certain locations like community colleges that would love for people to see that we're doing drills and exercises to be prepared for active shooters or a critical event. So that way they can demonstrate to their board of trustees and the students that go there that they're actually being prepared and getting equipped to deal with a major incident. And so when you really need to think about in those different areas, either public or private, what do they want? And ask them for their input, because they may want to go ahead and start thinking about media management.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of those things, I like what you brought out about the public versus private areas. If you have a large campus or a large area that you're going to be hosting a disaster exercise in, and only one part of it is going to be seen, and let's say you're hosting an active shooter incident, and all of a sudden one side of the campus does not know what the other side of the campus is doing, and all of a sudden there's a lot of police cars coming with no knowledge on the other side, could be for a very awkward situation. So if you are going to have these public versus private areas that you're going to be conducting these exercises, if you're in the public area, it might be good to put up some signage to say that there's a drill in place so that people do not get overly zealous in their attitudes and think that something may be going on that is not being told to everybody else, but just putting everybody on the same plane of awareness so that they understand. But as we go into, yeah.
That's a really good point about making sure your press information officer is actively involved in it. Oftentimes what we try to do is make sure our PIO is involved in the exercise planning process itself so that he or she can actually start putting out information, you know, a month in advance, 3 weeks in advance, 2 weeks in advance, and letting people know as the event is getting closer and closer of the exercise and what will be taking place. And they also do a great job of making sure not just on social media, but also handing out flyers to people in the area. So that way, whether it's vehicles, whether it's residents in the area, no one really starts to panic when things end up happening because they actually know what it is that's going to end up occurring.
That's a good point. We had that at my house. There's a school that's going through a renovation and they're just basically doing a tear down and a rebuild. But before they tore the school down during the summer, it was a great opportunity for the local sheriff's office and local police departments to go through and practice active shooter training within a school environment. And so about a week beforehand, the couple of public information officers and media management officers for the local sheriff's department put flyers on everybody's door who's around there, just warning them and letting them know that in the next week, there's going to be a couple of days that they're going to do active shooter exercises. There'll be a large police force that will be in the parking lot of the school, and not to be scared or panic because of that particular type of response. It's ongoing training. So it really helps when media management gets in front of the training incident to alert the public and those involved that this is regularly scheduled training, no need to be alarmed, and that everything will be taken care of in an orderly manner.
And I think really that goes back to the safety of the staff that is attending the events. Oftentimes exercises take place, as you just said, Ed, in abandoned vehicles or abandoned buildings. And one of the things we need to think about that we don't do a very good job is think about the health implications of using an abandoned building and what that actually looks like. I can tell you from past experience, I've crawled into a very tightly enclosed attic in which there's a bunch of stuff in there that I probably didn't want to be sitting in, but that was the exercise, that was the drill, so I did it. Looking back on it, probably would have been better to have some sort of breathing apparatus or making sure that I was not going to end up having any health problems later on. And really, one of the things we need to think about is what those abandoned buildings may end up containing and why it is that those buildings are given to us for training. Is it because they're tearing it down, remodeling it, or is it because they're going to completely gut it to make it a little bit more habitable for the people who are going to go back there and live there?
Excellent point, because since we talked about how budgets are really strapped and there's only so many amount of resources, a lot of times, and you can probably see them within your communities out there, is older homes may be offered for training burns to the local fire department, or as we saw it across the street, the school scheduled for demolition was offered to the police department to practice active shooter training. If you are giving those particular types of resources, that's great, but also, like Bill brought out there, make sure that there are health concerns that are taken care of, because the last thing we want to train to the most realistic spot that we possibly can. But we also, since we are training, want to take those precautions, whether it is weather precautions, equipment precautions, even paperwork and insurance precautions, to make sure that the training event goes off as smoothly as possible. Everybody gets the learning out of it. Everybody gets the experience, but nobody gets hurt. And that's our particular aim for when we are doing exercises.
And one of the things I remember, I did an active shooter exercise, and so I got a bunch of empty shell casings and threw them on the ground to try and make the training a little bit more realistic. What I didn't think about was the first person went on those shell casings, almost rolled their ankle, metal casings across the nice linoleum floor that was there. And so while trying to make the exercise realistic, it also became a safety issue. And once you see those safety issues, you need to jump on them right away and really start looking at all the other potential problems that may end up occurring, whether or not it's environmental for mold, whether or not it is feces from animals, whether or not it is shell casings on the ground, or whether or not there's going to be something that's going to end up impacting people to make it not just realistic, but potentially even a danger to them. We want to make sure that people do the training. We want to make sure it's realistic, Ed, as you said, but also we want to make sure that people are going to be safe. And at the end of this, it's about learning experience for them to learn to be successful, not learn how to be hurt.
Yeah, absolutely. If somebody gets hurt during the training process, that opportunity, which there's a lot of time and resources and effort that goes into it, if somebody gets hurt during that process, that training time gets put to a stop because the safety officer, which every training opportunity should have a safety officer, would call a full stop to that event to make sure that that injured party or that hazard is removed from there. And you may lose hours, you may lose resources and staff that were originally slated to be a part of that exercise that you might not be able to get back for the duration of it. And like I said, if it is a large scale event or if it is a large functional exercise that took years to plan or months, you won't get that time back if you don't take those precautions and those steps accordingly to make sure that nobody gets hurt beforehand.
And then one of the things that we end up doing is we have a actual range officer whenever there's any sort of simulation that's involved as part of his speech. And he has a laminated card where he reads it verbatim. His closing remark is always, all of you are safety officers. If any of you see anything that is unsafe, you need to immediately call index or stop exercise. And you need to wait until whatever it is that is not safe is rendered safe before any sort of training will continue. And really want to emphasize to all of our emergency managers and all the people listening to the podcast that you and everyone who's participating in the exercise is a safety officer. If you see anything at all that sticks out to you, that says, I probably shouldn't be doing this, then you're right. You probably shouldn't be doing this. You should call a timeout, regroup, see what you can do to mitigate the hazard, and then go ahead and proceed with the exercise after it's mitigated.
Yes, exactly. And that goes for any industry. When I was flying helicopters, if there was an unsafe environment or we just felt that it wasn't going according to plan and something was definitely unsafe, we had the ability as flight instructors to, quote, knock it off, at which point that ends the exercise and we regroup either to the staging area or we go back to base and hash out what happened and see if we can try to figure out if there was anything else that was occurring that may have caused that particular safety incident. Safety is number one. We train for the emergencies. We train for the disasters that are occurring, but safety is number one. We don't want to get anybody injured, no matter what industry, no matter what sector of emergency management we're in. We're doing our best to make sure that we can be at our top level, but we don't want to get hurt doing it.
And once you hang on after this pause for segment two, and we'll talk about how to even begin the planning process.
So we're going to talk about now how to begin the planning process. It is a complex piece to plan an exercise, no matter how big or small it is, in its way complex because you're gathering all to the table and anybody and everybody who will be associated with your location or your event needs to be invited. There's no one that is too big or no one that is too small. Wouldn't you agree, Bill?
Absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, everyone wants training. I can't think of anybody I've ever worked with who has said, I've gotten too much training. Everyone usually complains about how little training they have. And so, you know, really the very beginning of it is getting an educational background and looking at training from the FEMA websites, looking for training that's available that is in books, and getting an understanding of what exercises actually are. But then talk to people and find out what kind of training people want. You know, as emergency managers or people in the public or private sector, really what we always think to do is we think we know what training everyone needs. Yet really what we should be doing is asking the people who are actually doing the job, what is the training that you need to be successful at your job? They should be driving us rather than us driving them. Now we can help steer them in the right direction, but at the end of the day, they're the ones who are going to be doing the actual response when a critical event ends up happening. We want to give them the best possible training so that they can be successful at their jobs.
Yeah, 100%. Because that low-hanging fruit, the easiest thing that everybody across the board can get is that education. FEMA offers online training classes for basic incident command systems, so that they can get the basic ICS structure of what incident command looks like. Everybody could take it online. It can also be offered in classroom training, and it's really the low-hanging fruit of which builds the foundation for everything else that occurs in emergency management, no matter where they go from there. And as you're establishing what those training regimens are, it's good to have those pre-planning conferences and meetings and establish who's going to be there, and what the objectives are. Planning for meetings is very complex sometimes because you're having to get all of these different stakeholders and when they may be available and who needs to be there at a particular time. Maybe not everybody has to be at the very first one, but as we get closer to the event, more and more organizations and vendors, once we have the framework of our exercise, need to be brought into it.
Absolutely. And when you're thinking about planning for this actual exercise and planning for the meetings of the meetings, I can't believe I'm actually saying that, but when you're looking at the dates and times and meetings for meetings, you need to think about what days everyone usually can be free to meet. A lot of times what I've found is Tuesdays and Thursdays tend to be really good days, usually during the mid-morning, because that usually tends to be time that people are free. Then the other part of that is where are you actually going to have those meetings at, and trying to have it in a centralized location so
Yeah.
that no one can complain that, well, that meeting is just too far away and I can't get to it. Or better yet, look at what tech you can use to leverage the fact that people are across distances and can communicate, like we're using now on Anchor.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's a huge thing. It used to be a problem when you had a large metropolitan area and an event was going to occur within that area, let's say the Super Bowl or a large concert or a conference, like a political conference was going to occur. And so you had to get all these different stakeholders within the area into one place. Some people might not want to attend because they don't want to cross traffic and go an hour and a half into town for a meeting. But now that we have technology and we can leverage and open that up to Skype or Zoom, where people can come in and remotely, it offers us the ability to have so much more interaction and so much more people involved in the planning process than we possibly could have
And even one of the
even
tools
five
that I
years
use
ago.
is Slack. And I've come to a very great understanding of Slack and how it actually works. And if you haven't used it before, it actually is a great product where you can share information, photographs, video, Word documents, and it's again free. And it's one of the things that ends up helping you trying to plan this exercise. Plus, it keeps a digital record of the notes as you're typing it. So that way you can look back on and say, what is it that ended up happening? What did we actually agree to? And I think that leads to our next point about the location for the event or the exercise is trying to find out where you're actually going to do it. Oftentimes we've tried to do exercises at locations where we thought it was a great day to do it. It was a Saturday, and then we realized that there was an event actually occurring on that Saturday. And what are the ways can we look for locations to actually hold events?
Yeah, so a couple of the other ways that you can find these events, since you're going to be bringing a lot of people and people bring resources and people have to be there for a long part of the day, you're going to have to think about where, if equipment is coming in, where can that equipment be staged? Whether it's in large parking lots or if they're vehicles or if it's equipment that would have to be staged inside a warehouse. And then you have to just consider creature comforts for all of us as humans. We have to use the restroom, we have to have food and water, and you have to have safety and first aid. So you have to have all these locations. If you're bringing hundreds of people, let's take, for example, an airport that does a drill for a plane crash, and so it's a mass casualty incident. You're talking hundreds of people out on the airfield during a active day where flight operations may still be occurring on other parts of the airfield. But now you're bringing in all of the resources, the EMS, law enforcement, and you bring in the volunteers, and you're putting them out in a field that's really not conducive to having bathrooms or food and water. So you need to have these things thought out, excuse me, and put in particular areas that are going to be able to be comfortable for people who are participating in the
Absolutely. And I think the
exercise.
last thing for that is think about a location that has first aid. Every time we do an exercise, what we plan on is not only having first aid that's available on scene, whether or not it's fire or paramedics, but also the location of hospitals in the nearby area, whether or not you may need an LZ to land a helicopter if you have one available to you, but also the closest hospital and how long it'll take driving time to get to that location if you have to transport someone immediately. When we're thinking about first aid, we think about all the things that may go into it, weather, electrical, water, whatever it may be, thinking about the things that may end up impacting people who are going to be participating in the exercise.
Hey, bingo. You got a great point there when you're talking about if you do an exercise that is offsite and not normally a place where people associate on a daily basis, let's say you're doing a festival type exercise, a mass casualty at a Coachella type festival, or what we have here in the Pacific Northwest, a Sasquatch Music Festival. These occur outside of the normal city limits with very limited transportation options in and out. Maybe one main thoroughfare up here, it's Interstate 84 when you're going through the gorge east and west. And so if you're going to be practicing a large scale exercise out in those particular areas, like Bill said, make sure that you have adequate time and resource to be able to get somebody who may be injured on that site out to a particular type of hospital so that they can get the medical care needed, and not something that if you're out in the mountains practicing a mountain search and rescue, that it may take a lot of time to get them off the mountain. I know that our mountain search and rescue teams that go up to Mount Hood will do exercises up there, and that if they do have injuries which have occurred, it does take a while to get them, those who are practicing the exercise, off the mountain and then inbound to the hospitals in the Portland metro area. That could take up to 45 minutes, maybe longer, if they don't have access to a helicopter, and depending on the nature of where they may have been injured, if they've fallen into a crevasse or somewhere inaccessible on part of Mount Hood.
And I think, Ed, you bring up sort of the last thing for me for the pre-planning, which is having timelines. And I think it's really important to start off, obviously, establishing what date you're going to be having the exercise, but then really mapping out actually minute by minute, if you will, of the exercise and what's going to end up taking place. Because if you build in those extra blocks of time to reset during an actual exercise, not only can you make sure your people are staying hydrated, not only can you make sure that they're staying fed, you can check for injuries. And also, in case you do have to provide any sort of medical treatment, you build in that time to go ahead and make sure those people are treated, removed from the exercise area if they need to be. And also make sure you do what you can to make sure that everyone else is getting ready for the next evolution of it. Because you're going to have first responders hopefully coming in and out of this exercise and making sure that they're rendering themselves safe and they're actually checking in with somebody. Oftentimes what I've found is if you have a doctor or a nurse or a firefighter or a paramedic, they can just do one quick check of people and say any injuries. And that's usually the best way to go ahead and clear the exercise. If no one has any injuries, then everyone's free to go. If someone does have an injury, you're immediately documenting the injury and putting it down for workers' comp, because you have to remember, if you're using people for your exercise, they're probably employed by somebody, even if they're volunteering their time, you own them. And so if someone gets injured, you got to make sure all the paperwork is filled out, because nothing's worse than someone getting an injury and then there's no documentation for it when the agency asks, well, what kind of treatment did they get provided and why didn't we know anything about it?
Excellent point. We get ourselves involved in the how cool it is to talk about disasters and we're going to practice an active shooter thing, that we don't get so bogged down with the details, like you brought out, that if somebody gets hurt, there is paperwork afterwards. They are part of an agency. It may impact the way their work style or their ability to work, and that has to breed for workman's comp. If they go to the hospital, that's an insurance matter. Who's covering the cost for that? It's not the cool stuff that we see when we talk about fire trucks rolling on scene or police officers entering a building, but it is just important, if not more so, for all of us doing our jobs in emergency management and other first responders to make sure that if something does happen, we are taken care of post exercise, that is afterwards. And that brings up a great point and a great segue into the post exercise debrief. Once that exercise is over, what are we doing at that point?
I think at that point, yeah, that's really where you end up doing a hot wash and really getting everyone who's there to go ahead and participate in that. And having some open and honest conversation about what worked and what didn't work. And, you know, really what we fail to do is we fail to go ahead and bring up the negative, because we don't want to hurt anyone's ego. We don't want to make anyone feel bad. But here's the deal. You don't really look to hurt somebody for what they failed to do. What you're looking to do is you're trying to help them increase their skill set so that during a critical exercise or event, they're going to be successful. Because if you're not being open and honest, and if you're worried about everyone's ego, you're not going to be able to get that feedback, or you're not being able to give that feedback that's going to end up helping someone. Really what you're doing is really is holding someone back. And that's really going to end up making a critical difference when you actually have an exercise or an event that ends up happening.
Yeah, because once, if you have an actual event of something that you actually practiced in the exercise, and things went wrong in the actual event that you knew went wrong in the exercise, but were not put in as an update or an improvement, that is going to come back to bite everybody in the rear end, because most of the time, these exercises, or I'm sorry, these events, after they are concluded, have litigation that comes in, and they will go through tooth and nail with a fine-tooth comb at everything in your training plans, your training exercises, to identify whether or not you identified that that was a problem, did not improve upon it, that incident occurred, somebody got hurt or killed, and now the litigation and the lawyers come in, and that could be a huge stain on your organization, your agency, and if you're a private business, that can be a business-ending situation if you do not have the resources to be able to take care of those legal fees and the aftermath of what
And
happens.
that brings up, Ed, I think the last point for this one, for the post-exercise debrief part, is really getting someone to be a scribe. And whether or not that's a audio scribe or someone's just recording it on their telephone, or whether that's someone who's taking notes, making sure that they're going to actually take detailed information that they can then use to go back and you can look at your plans and how to update them and make sure you prepare an exercise for the next time. Because again, if you're not being open and honest, you're not able to go ahead and update your plans to modify them for what needs to have an update to allow people to be successful, because oftentimes you may think that, well, you did it one time, so therefore it's successful. Some organizations have existed since the 1800s, and so they think, well, it worked well in the 1800s, but you know what? It's going to keep working well. Here we are in 2018, when that's not really the fact. And you're not being open and honest with yourself or your organization. You're not doing yourself or your business any sort of good at all. Instead, you're actually holding yourself back from being the best possible organization you can be.
Yep. And since we are in 2018, social media is a huge part of our daily lives and should be included in every emergency exercise that we do, both within the actual exercise itself, as well as afterwards and interacting with the public. And when they have questions about what was that, all those police cars or those fire trucks that were at the airport, was there a plane crash? Identify social media use prior to the incident. Push out notifications through your agency bands to say, hey, we are going to be conducting an exercise. You may see additional personnel and resources and trucks in this particular area. Don't be alarmed if nothing is going on, because those things kind of do freak people out. And at times they may post to social media that something's happening, and the last thing you want is misinformation on a scheduled event getting out to the public. And then now they think you may be hiding something when in fact, this had been a months-long exercise that had been going into plan.
And really, you know, it's the idea of in the absence of knowledge, chaos ensues. And really thinking about if you don't put out any information, you're going to allow everyone else to dictate what it is that's being said. And that's where I think it's important to sort of follow event trends or identify hashtags for the event or preset them by presetting the hashtag for the event so you can follow it on Twitter or follow it on social media. It'll allow you to have a better understanding of what everyone else is talking about. In this day and age, you're going to end up getting most of your information probably from social media, if not from the 911 calls you're going to start receiving after the exercise begins. But if you end up identifying how to communicate what you're going to be doing, it allows you and anyone else who's monitoring the exercise to make sure you're staying up to date, providing people with live information. And who knows, you may be able to get prep exercise and actually enhance your emergency management program by getting the word out there of what you're doing and use it as a possible commercial. And we'll actually give a plug for a future podcast about emergency notifications and how to get information out there. You may be training, and this gives you an opportunity to go ahead and actually plug away at what your communication networking is for emergency notifications. So you could use it as sort of a commercial and roll it out.
Yeah, absolutely. The main thing that you want to do when we talk about this are planning, everything that goes into this. We're using resources, we're using personnel, we're using time, and we're using money. And if we are a public agency, if you are in charge of a public agency, you are stewards of the public good. So making sure that that happens in the best possible light, that we are putting the best use of resources and training for the community, really breeds dividends down the line for building trust within your community and those that you are slated to protect.
And I think that really builds into sort of the last segment part of this is which is why are you testing this? You know, what are you looking to test? Has it been done before? When was the last time you tested? And what were the past learning experiences? This is why it's so important to take detailed notes to make sure you have things written down about why you're doing this actual exercise and explain it to the people who are participating. It's pretty easy for us just to think, hey, we're going to roll out this training. It's not that easy when we start thinking about, well, we're going to explain to everybody why we're doing this and give them a bigger picture. But as has been said time in and time out, people are a lot more invested if they understand the reason why. People always want to know why. People always ask the question why. So let's give them the why and get that out of the way.
And that's a good point, Bill, because that's what we're going to do. Our next segment will be on exercises, and it will be about the why. So we ended up, Bill, why don't you go ahead and follow up again with us on the objective of why we are testing when it comes to an exercise?
Well, absolutely. We don't just hold exercises to hold exercises. I think sometimes we people get lost in that. They're like, we just need to have an exercise because we haven't done it in a long time. Well, that's the wrong reason to go ahead and do it. The reason why you're doing it is to hopefully test something that's already been written down or test something that's never been written down before. With us, we had an exercise recently where we actually did a evacuation from the side of a park where we stationed people all the way around the park and tried to go ahead and figure out whether or not we could actually use our radios, interoperability with our fire department, with our law enforcement, with our search and rescue, because we had brand new equipment. And so for us, the reason why was to test the equipment and see what and by explaining that to not only the people who are responding to it, not only the people designing the exercise, but explaining it to the people who are participating in the exercise, it made the exercise successful. And we actually identified several shortcomings that we actually had and were able to fix them and address them for future exercises.
And good point there. We're not going to have an exercise just because we haven't done one. If you're in private industry and you go through there's a mindset that, hey, we have to do a fire drill because we haven't done a fire drill in a year and it's required by law. If you're thinking about the purpose of exercising isn't to make a check mark in a box. The purpose of effective exercising and effective training is to make sure that you are ready when that situation occurs. If you only do it to the point that you have to check the box because it's a regulatory matter, your organization and your employees will not be at the level of competency they need and will not understand what goes through that particular event because you just checked the box. And like you brought out, if your departments there did not test the new radio systems and interoperability of the particular radio systems, you would not know that until that actual situation came about. And that will be the worst time to figure out that your team wasn't ready or your equipment wasn't up to par. And so that's why effective exercises are so important. You know, what were those past learning experiences? What can we learn from other agencies and organizations?
I think that goes into really when you're setting up the exercise and you think about the why, now you need to think about where. Where are you going to hold the exercise and where are you going to hold the base for that exercise? Because the base should be something that's going to be able to see everything that's going on or at least hear everything that's going on and make sure they stay in constant communication with not only the people who are the role players, but the people who are first responders. And we need to think about their safety as well. And again, referring back to this exercise we had in the middle of the morning, it rolled from 3 o'clock in the morning until 7 o'clock in the morning. And we had to be wary of a few things. We had to be wary about people tripping and falling. We had to be worried about poison oak in the area. We had to be worried about animals in the area because we had a lot of mountain lion sightings and what we would do in case it ended up happening. And also the observations of the people who are going to be participating in the drill. We want to make sure they knew what it is that they need to be prepared for, whether or not it was going to be something extremely cold, which in this situation it was. I mean, California is relative. Cold for us is, you know, 30 degrees. Unlike you, Ed, I'm sure up there where you've been in the 20s or the teens, right?
Occasionally, I mean, cold for us is in the 30s as well, too. But I'll tell you, when other people go indoors because it's raining, we're like, oh, it's a Tuesday up here.
Well, and I think that goes back to, you know, making sure that everyone who is actually participating in it understands what their role is as well. So not only where's the exercise, where's the base, but understanding what their role is. You know, are they supposed to go ahead and actually follow a script about what they're going to be doing? So we want them to go ahead and participate, make them as realistic as possible, but we want to make sure it's not sort of ad-libbed. In some exercises, people have gone off script. And once they go off script, you don't know what it is that's going to end up happening. And the worst thing we can do, again, is have a real life emergency or real life injury. And that's why we script things out. And sometimes you have to remember that role players, they don't necessarily follow the script.
Right, exactly. And so you may have in a particular exercise a simulation cell, which is a group of individuals and people who are offset away from the site, or maybe giving the, as the exercise goes on, they are the opposing or the red force, or they're throwing injects into the exercise to really turn it into a dynamic training environment to let you think. And so that everybody can kind of knows how to run through a situation. But then if somebody puts in an interjection that says, hey, you just got this piece of intelligence, or you just got this radio call, how is that going to impact your decision-making? How is that now going to impact what you're going to do in the next step? Let's say you had planned to put people over at a triage site that was close to a building or close to a park, but then maybe there were other simulated attackers, or maybe there was other simulated devices that were unsure of in that particular area. Well, now you have to make that decision on the fly because the simulation cell told you, hey, we've discovered some additional places over here where we can't put because it's not quite safe. It's not in the cold zone. These simulation cells do really good to make dynamic thinking happen and critical thinking happen with your responders and with your personnel who are going through, but they are scripted. And they are expected by certain people, especially those who are observing the exercise, who can be the observers of what's going on and let people know if that is happening. Hey, we're getting a script here. Here it is. Go for it.
And that goes to evaluation and really looking at who is doing the evaluation. Are they people who are going to be highly critical because they don't like the people participating in the exercise? Are they people who have credentials and have an educational background and understanding how the exercise is supposed to be working and what people are supposed to be doing when they're responding to the actual event itself? Or are they just somebody you hired off the street to say yes and check all the boxes? And really, that goes down to who selects the people who are doing the evaluation. Was there a reason for them to be selected? Were they selected because they want the program to be successful, or they want the program to fail so that way they could justify some funding? I will tell you that when you start looking at people to do evaluations, you want to look at somebody who's going to be open and honest, somebody who's going to be able to, again, check their ego at the door, and somebody who's going to be able to give the people who are participating in the exercise good feedback and also a honest evaluation of what could be improved upon, but also things that went well. Oftentimes, we get really, really negative in public safety, and that's the worst thing we can do because we detract from what the exercise value is. If something went well, then you need to highlight that. In one of the exercises I saw for an active shooter exercise, I saw someone who was 5'2" climbing the outside of a train to look inside the cab of a train, even though it had not been identified as being that's where the person was hiding out to go ahead and participate in the shooting. She went above and beyond. She did an exceptional job. And after the exercise was over, we commented about that. And we highlighted the fact that here's this person who's a little bit shorter than most of the people who I'm working with, but she went above and beyond that no one else was even thinking about and went in that extra step to go ahead and look for maybe that's the location where that person's hiding.
And great point. And if you take those things that we just talked about, who's doing the evaluating, who's looking in, and what are they looking for? I'll tell you, in private industry is very, very protective of their items, whether it's intellectual property, whether it's their departments, whether it's what they're manufacturing. They are very, very protective of the information and don't necessarily want other people and other departments within their organization maybe see what they're doing. They don't want to air out their dirty laundry or their preparedness or their lack of preparedness. And so if you are hiring an evaluator and you bring in an outside consultant or an emergency manager who has experience, who can be an objective third party and actually praise the good things and constructively build what needs to be improved on, they're going to be a lot more receptive to an outsider that may be coming in and saying, hey, these are the things we can use within the organization, within the department, within your personnel to improve the training process and do it in a way that is identifies the weaknesses and the failures that may have been seen, but also builds upon the good things that they saw. Like you brought out, going above and beyond in searching for where a particular shooter might be, or going above and beyond the resources and the resource requests that a private owned industry or an organization may need when they respond to a disaster.
Absolutely. And when you're looking at who's doing the evaluation, we said this in our first podcast together, and I'm going to reemphasize it again. Diversity is key. Having a different perspective is the most important thing for this. So rather than getting the same evaluator, someone who has a law enforcement background or someone who has a fire background, get as many different groups of people as possible to be your evaluators. Have one from each discipline, or better yet, have one from each discipline and also from different ages, different sexes, different experience levels. So that way you get people to understand, hey, all these people doing the evaluation see things differently, and they all have a different spin, and all these viewpoints are an extra added bonus to help us figure out how to do our jobs better and really find out what their level of experience and training is also. Who verified it? And someone say, hey, that guy or that girl is perfect. They're the best evaluator on the face of the planet. But then you look into what their background is and they've never done an evaluation. They're just looking for something to pad their resume. Or better yet, someone who says that person doesn't know what they're talking about. They don't have any experience. And you look into their background and you find, oh, they responded to 12 or 13 different critical events that end up happening. They actually led the exercises before. So don't just rely on what people tell you, but actually do your own research to make sure the people you're getting are the best quality people and also have the most diverse backgrounds as possible to get the best possible learning experience.
That's right. Disasters do not discriminate who they affect. We saw that with the hurricane season of last year with Harvey, Irma, and Maria. They attack a wide area, and all aspects of the socioeconomic calendar, all areas of the region. So making sure that you get everybody involved from these different viewpoints and how that disaster is going to affect them is very, very important. Good point there, Bill.
And the other thing is we need to ask about whether or not we want to bring the evaluators into the planning process. And I think there's some pros and some cons. Ed, what do you think about the pros and cons?
Well, when you think about bringing them into the planning process, it's interesting because they get to see what's going on. They get to see everything that is happening within the planning process. But then that gives them a lot more to base their feedback on. And that might not be something that you want. As you're going through and you're identifying weaknesses within the planning process and the evaluator is right next to you, that may come into account when that evaluation comes through. They may have a certain bias or tendency to say that organization from the very beginning isn't going to be operating as high as I think they are. And that may be detrimental to your record or to what happens. But then the pro about having them in the planning process is that they are involved and they get to see everything from step one all the way to the execution of the exercise and understand the cohesiveness and that this is a good group. The planning process went well. There wasn't anything missed out on between any of the stakeholders that were involved. And so, I mean, you have to gauge it, the pro and con of having the evaluators in the planning process. And that's something that, you know, an organization can determine.
Absolutely. I think that also we need to start thinking about what technology everyone's going to need for the exercise. And for technology, you can have the basics. And I think you have to have the basics in order to be successful. You have to have the people who are going to be participating in this exercise. I would recommend having computers where you can start doing all the things you need to do, whether or not it's putting together PowerPoint slides, pulling up video from past exercises, looking at social media. Really, that's almost a thing that's necessity by this point. Then you have to have the radios of the people who are going to be able to communicate in different frequencies. And this is where it's important to involve your dispatchers. Again, one of the often overlooked resources that are available to you are dispatchers. And oftentimes they're in a faraway land known as the safe building where there's coffee and they have a chance to go ahead and be indoors. But the problem is they want to know what you're doing and they really have no idea what you're doing unless you communicate with them. And really involving dispatchers in the planning process is extremely important. And they're the ones who can give you the radio channels you need so that you can go ahead and communicate. And that gets to the last point, which is telephones. You need to have telephones. Even if you have radios, there's going to be places that are going to be radio dead spots. So make sure you have a telephone where people can actively communicate with each other. And are there any other things that you need for our basics before we move on to the nice to haves?
You know, I'm right there with you when it comes to as a dispatcher myself, I absolutely say that because if those people, those voices on the other end who are talking and who are managing the incident from afar, if they're not part of the process, you're missing out on a vital link of resource management to get into the planning process. So definitely use those dispatchers out there. And I think pen and paper. I mean, have something to write these things down. Don't just rely on memory. If you are, I mean, it's not technology. I mean, it's basic stuff for us, but definitely have pen and paper handy, ready to go, so that you can write down things that occurred during the incident.
And I think, you know, the nice to haves would be a camera or some sort of recording device. One of our local agencies is very familiar with the tech company that is around producing telephones, or I'm sorry, producing cameras, GoPro. And so they got GoPro to donate several cameras to them to help them during their exercise and training. So that way they could see how it is they could improve their training by taking sort of still shots and also video. Again, reaching out to those tech companies to see what they may be willing to offer you. A lot of times companies are willing to go ahead and offer you a product to let you go ahead and do a beta test with it. So reach out to them and look at them as a resource and involve them possibly in the planning process to see what they want to do. One of the local companies here needed sounds of gunshots. And so in exchange for us taking them out to the range, they're able to provide recording devices for us. And I think that that's an often overlooked opportunity that you have a partner in the community. So reach out to them, become friends with them, involve in the planning process because they're going to end up helping you. And that goes to the next point where they may be providing you with role players. It's amazing to me how many people who are programmers, especially here in Silicon Valley, would want nothing more than to get shot by simulation. It befuddles me on a daily basis. It is absolutely hilarious to see them compare their bruises after they've been shot with the simulation. And of course, we check with them, make sure they're okay. We have them sign waivers, but they like to play the bad guys and they get a chance to sort of feel what it's like to be involved as a first responder. So don't overlook them. And I think the last thing is get people outside of the evaluators to look at your exercise. And by outside, I mean, think about people who are not normally brought into it. Think about people from the press and ask them what they're looking for in the exercise. And I know, ooh, that's scary to bring them involved in the exercise. And yeah, it is scary. But what better to get positive feedback and what better to ask them what they're looking for so that during a critical event, you know what their perspective is and you look at their viewpoint. Ask students to participate. They're going to be scared during a critical event if it happens on their campus. So ask them to help out, whether that's a nursing student who maybe is trying to get some extra credit. Maybe it's someone who's going through the police academy, the fire academy, or better yet, someone who's actually an illustrator or a graphic artist. They may be willing to shoot video for you and use them as an actual resource to participate in the exercise, but then you can use them later on and give them extra credit or sign off on an experience that they've now participated in.
Absolutely. If you are out there, me and Bill are both very active when it comes to utilizing social media and upcoming technologies within the emergency management field. And you're going to start to see a podcast later on talk more and more about the different types of technologies that are out there. If you have access and if you have the opportunity to work within those in your community who have tech that can help you in your response or your planning, work with them. Because Bill brought out a great use case that they're able to offer resources and equipment that you might not normally be able to get and able to implement them within your exercise and definitely improve your agency's training, as well as the whole pointing fingers. It's better to do handshakes instead of pointing fingers that Bill brought out in our previous couple other podcasts. I know I butchered
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. It's better to shake hands before a disaster than pointing fingers after. I can't emphasize enough how important it is to build those relationships so that way you know who those people are. You can call them, you can speak to them so that after the event ends up happening, you're not pointing fingers at each other, but you're talking about how successful it is and again, how you can possibly improve it.
Excellent. So, that it concludes this episode here. We'll be right back with a couple of parting messages. Well, what are our big takeaways from today, would you say, Bill?
Well, I think the big takeaways from today is really thinking about the planning process and identifying who the stakeholders are before you even begin. And that means everyone. No one's too big, no one's too small. And at the end of the day, everyone really wants to go ahead and participate in training. The low-hanging fruit for that is really an educational background and having the basic understanding of what you're going to be exercising and I would say even why.
Yeah, excellent. And then as you do that and you begin that planning process, you get everybody involved, make sure to be cognizant of the time frames that you're exercising. Make sure to be cognizant of where you're exercising. Make sure you have the proper resources and basic outreach to the public using your social media and your public information officer to get that message across as saying to the public, we're doing our exercises here. No need to be alarmed.
And I think the other thing about that is really doing a good job in doing a hot wash. And by hot wash, that means really looking at a debrief of the exercise and thinking about getting as many people's different perspectives as possible. In emergency management, we are wonderfully abundant in having people from all sorts of different walks of life. And that means everyone who works in fire, in law, in public works, communication systems, paramedics, everyone you can think of has an opportunity to contribute and bring them into not only the planning process, but the hot wash process to have them provide their input and have them give you something that's really good, that golden nugget that you can take back and go, I never thought about that, but we need to start thinking about that in future exercises.
Excellent. And with that thought in mind, what are we going to talk about next week?
Well, I think that if people turn into our commercial, which you can check at the very top of our podcast, you'll see what we're viewing next week.
Excellent. So we thank you for listening into State of Ready. You can find State of Ready on Anchor, on the Anchor app. You can find us on Apple or on iTunes, Overcast, Pocket Cast, and Radio Public as well, too. If you want to get in touch with me, my name is Ed. I'm the owner of Ready Northwest. You can get in touch with me at Ready_Northwest. Or LinkedIn at Edward Colson, or email me at edward@readynorthwest.com.
And you can reach me, Bill Fogarty, on LinkedIn, or you can tag me at Twitter at 21klets, or my website at www.21klets.com. We look forward to hearing from you next week. And again, as always, if you have any input to our show, feel free to reach out to us and let us know.
Everybody have a good one.